really like to open up the floor now to the audience for a discussion so that we can get a good discussion going. And our audience like to call in people and have our speakers actually come back at the end of the discussion so that they can each wrap up and make the points that they feel need to be made rather than just having a back and forth with the speaker. So I will take hands, and I'm hoping people, want to jump in. So I'm going to turn it back to our speakers in order, which would mean starting with Russ.
I was asked about really the prospects of getting rid of the death penalty in the South, Southeast, I think someone asked that. I guess what's behind that question is that it just seems like so much stronger there. The death penalty is so much stronger in the South, and I think that's true. It is. And the history of the death penalty in the South is completely different than it is in the rest of the country, because in the South, after the Civil War, lynching was first used to keep black people in their place as part of the way to keep black people in their place, and then the death penalty replaced lynching as the means to do the same thing legally that had been going on illegally. So the history and the culture in the southern part of this country is one where the death penalty plays a very particular role in the whole system of white supremacy that still exists in that part of the country and in the history and in the culture. And it's a much harder nut to crack. And just as to say that now in New York State only 34% of the people, the entire population in the state, supports the death penalty, is not to say that you could have that same thing happen in the South. But I think that what is going to happen is that the South will become increasingly isolated in the country, and that's why you'll wind up with a national policy that'll get rid of the death penalty. I think it'll take a long, long time for the people in this country and the people in the South to get to the point that Suja talked about, where we all realize our common humanity and our common interrelationships and really are in a position to get rid of racism to the extent that you would have to have a majority position in the South, particularly among white people, to get rid of the death penalty. I don't think it's going to happen that way. I think it's going to happen nationally rather than regionally.
The reason I ask is it varies from one state to another in the Southeast. Mississippi, for example, has not executed as many people as Louisiana. Partly it's money problems here. They're under the county that has to push the bill for an execution, and none of the counties have the kind of money that Harris County in Houston, Texas has, and that's one reason why they've had far fewer executions there than in neighboring Louisiana or in Alabama.
I have three things. Contact information. I didn't talk about the Rosenberg Fund for Children, which is what I do full time and have done full time since 1990. There are newsletters up here that have all sorts of information if you want to come this way instead of only going back there to look at the literature tables. And anybody who wants to find out information or to contact me, you can go to our website, which is www.rfc.org. That's about as simple an address as you can find, rfc.org. More substantive answer, question about the USA Patriot Act and conspiracy clauses. That act is 342 pages long. I can't claim to have memorized it and to be able to tell you word for word what the conspiracy clauses say. I can say that in general, what it does is it creates these incredibly broad definitions. For instance, giving material aid to a terrorist organization. That's how Lynn Stewart got convicted and faces 40 years in prison. And what was the material aid she gave? She held a press conference at which she stated what her client was saying to the world, okay? And she faces 40 years in prison for doing that. Now, then you go one step further if you are involved with other people, if you get together with other people to plot a terrorist act, and I don't know the exact language, substantial likelihood that someone will be killed, or if somebody is going to be, if someone is killed, then you have the death penalty. And the definitions of what constitute terrorism are so broad that literally going, sitting down, as some people did on the main street in Northampton, and lying down and blocking traffic could be considered terrorism under the USA Patriot Act. Now, of course, Ashcroft and now his Gonzalez, the one who wrote the torture memos, who's our new attorney general. You know, I like to think of Bush as not only the commander-in-chief, but the torturer-in-chief. But now they say, of course, we won't use it this way. But it's on the books. And then, of course, there's the final level. The administration talks about enemy combatant. Okay? The phrase enemy combatant had no specific legal meaning until the Bush administration picked it up. It was something in the Geneva Accords having to do with warfare that was a general descriptive category. If you were from the enemy and you were involved in combat, you were, quote-unquote, an enemy combatant, and you were entitled to certain kind of rights. It was a category. The Bush administration has taken that phrase and pulled it out in order to describe people they can hold because they feel like it and do whatever they want to whenever they want to. That means they literally can take someone, hold them, execute them without trial, whatever they want, because they've designated them as that. That's not in the Patriot Act. That's what the Bush administration, their general policy. And there was a court case recently in which the judge was asking the government about this enemy combatant status and created a series of hypotheticals. And he said to the prosecutor, take the example of a grandmother in Switzerland who gives some money to an organization that she thinks is providing humanitarian aid in the Middle East, but it turns out that that money is funneled to Al-Qaeda without her knowledge. Could she be declared an enemy combatant and taken to Guantanamo and summarily executed? Answer, yes, Your Honor. What about someone who teaches English to the children of Al-Qaeda members? Answer, yes. What about a newspaper reporter who refuses to provide, who has some information about Al-Qaeda members and refuses to supply it? Answer, yes. All of these people, according to the government, could be declared enemy combatants, taken out of society, moved to Guantanamo, held indefinitely, and even executed. That's the kind of rule that we have now, and that's the context that it's fit in. Finally, I just want to mention, as sort of an aside, someone brought up the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, a very well-known case, I'm sure very well-known in this valley. There's a misunderstanding that has spread that because at the federal level, at the federal trial court level, the sentencing part of his case was overturned and therefore he, quote-unquote, no longer faces the death penalty, that's a misunderstanding. The state immediately appealed that to the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. Mumia is one court away from execution. If they uphold overturn that decision of the court below and uphold the death penalty, the only place he has to go is the Supreme Court, and we all know what that court is about. So I just want to urge people to keep an eye on this case. It is not solved. It is actually in a very critical stage.
Okay. So let me first say that Chicopee is not, it's not a done deal, okay? So Greenfield may be more moving towards actual construction, which at that point you have a building. If you build it, they will fill it, right? I don't think folks should stop working trying to make sure that those beds aren't filled and continue to call for a moratorium. But Chicopee is not a done deal. So what are we doing? Well, last April, we held a legislative teach-in. We invited all of the Hampden County delegation of legislators to come and hear about alternatives to incarceration, right? They're far more effective and far less costly, proven in states all over the country. And you hear about this stuff all the time now because states have been in budget crises like they haven't been for many, many years because of the war. So they've been having to figure out from state to state, what the heck are they going to do with this prison population that they can no longer afford? So we've been really trying to work that angle, which is also to say, we're in a budget crisis. Social services have been slashed like nothing else, right? When we think about treatment, 60% of the treatment beds have been cut in our state. There are no detox beds in Franklin County. None. Zero. That whole county does not have a detox bed. So what are we need to pressure our reps, right? But it's not in their hands. This is right now a governor's decision. So it's already gone that far. It's the governor's decision to pass this thing or not. And he did put a hold on it before. And what we've been trying to do is hold him accountable to his earlier statements of, we're going to think about being smart on crime, right? That came from Edward Flynn, the public safety secretary. And then he followed suit with that. The governor said, let's evaluate whether or not it makes sense to build more prisons for women in this case. This was a year ago, November. So we've really been trying to target the governor. We have these postcards that some of you have filled out, and you should look at the letter that's on there that's written to the governor. So you should go to your reps. You should not let them get away with saying, oh, well, we agree. You should ask them, what are they doing to talk to the governor? What are they doing to get at the governor? And really push them to the point of telling you, maybe they're going to tell you, this is a done deal, so just go home now. Well, then you know that they're not doing anything anymore because they're all locked into this position of it's a done deal. And then I don't think you should go away. I think you should stay on them. And I think if folks believe that others are at this work and taking care of it, you're so dead wrong. This is going to take every one of us in this room and beyond to become outraged and talk to our reps like we've never talked to them before, to get this thing in the public. We've done a lot of work around publicity, trying to get letters to the editor. And I think right now, if everyone here went out and wrote a letter to the editor in all of the local papers in Greenfield, in Northampton, and in Springfield, we'd be that much farther along. We need to have a public outcry, right? And we haven't had it yet. So as much as our coalition has been working with the media, trying to get everything we do, we write a press release for, trying to get them there, we had a gap of time where the press just wouldn't cover us. And we had to really then contact them and have a little fit with them. But I think everyone needs to have a public outcry. So letters to the editor, op-ed pieces. We need to demand a moratorium on all new jail expansion. I think we need to demand a cost-benefit analysis. Nobody's done it around the construction of the Chicopee Jail. I can tell you that we're not going to save any money. In fact, it's going to cost us $12 million at least each year to operate once the thing's built. Once we borrow $27 million, which every one of you who pays taxes in this state will pay back with interest over the course of however many years, right? So, but it's not done. We've got to continue to hang on here till the end. So what are we doing? Well, let me just answer the INS questions. Franklin County has overpopulated their jail like the Ludlow Jail has also. They have upwards of 180 men. Sometimes they have 2, 3, 4, 5 women. And 40% of that population are INS detainees. And they have a huge federal contract. And I don't know, and this stuff doesn't, it barely even gets out there, right? They have a huge federal contract with the U.S. Marshal's Office for this new coming jail, and I don't know the exact amount, but it's bigger than what they're doing right now. Chicopee also will house INS folks. So for people who are doing immigrants' rights work, boy, this is a place to just really come in with us and help us because we're really just so hurting for people power and all these angles. But the Sheriff Ash has already been awarded over $1 million for 40 beds to house INS folks. So he's already received that money, hoping that this new jail will happen and then they'll just put the women there. But right now they're housing them in Ludlow. So he's already received over $1 million for that contract. And I would imagine that that would increase if they actually get this larger jail to go in Chicopee, that that's somehow how they'll make up this difference. This is a real trend to disappear folks, right? And they get big money from the feds for it. So April, We've decided that we're going to launch a month worth of demonstrations in the month of April, knowing that this really could be it. We're not believing that completely, but this could be it. So if groundbreaking does happen as reported in May, which I'm praying it doesn't, this will be at least a last hurrah of sorts of really trying to turn up the heat and have us also get a lot of publicity. Starting on April 8th, we will hold a press conference at Arise for Social Justice in Springfield. And that afternoon and every weekend for that weekend and the next two thereafter, we will transport a constructed jail cell to different sites in Chicopee, with every Friday going to the site where the jail is proposed to be constructed on Center Street. And then Saturday and Sunday we'll go to malls and churches and whatnot, and we will have some talking points and give out some information to the Chicopee community. Amidst that, on April 21st, which is a Thursday, we are trying to mobilize people to go stand out at the State House. So we're calling attention to our Boston partners in the coalition to organize their constituencies out that way and stand out that day, demanding our legislature call for a moratorium on new jail construction.
So, what week is that?
It's a Thursday.
All
day. I'm sorry to say, we have really just kind of come together with this within the last week, and I don't have all the time, so we'll have to follow up with folks through the emails. And if anyone's picked up any of the information on SHARC on that back table, there's a phone number on there that would get you right to me. Then you could call anytime. And email is outnow@comcast.net. But again, all this stuff can circulate through this sign-in sheet that's happened. So we really would love to have as much support as we can. If people need to take the day off from work, well, please do it, right? If you can, do it. We're going to get transportation together for folks that don't have rides. We'll be coordinating all of this. And this really, truly could be it. So legal avenues, we've been exploring a few different avenues, and we keep kind of coming to a roadblock. And part of our problem is having an attorney so if there's any lawyers out there who want to help us tease some of this stuff out, we have a lot of ideas. And one of them in particular is around gender. So in 1994, the Truth in Sentencing Law, it allowed for intermediate sanctions to be offered for a certain level of nonviolent offense. And it approved for money to be put in place to support these intermediate sanctions. This is what they call them. We call them alternatives to incarceration. But money's never been put towards them, so they don't exist. So this is the stuff with the mandatory minimums, right? So the judges get this person that comes before them, they look down the grid, and they say, okay, you've committed this crime with this many priors or no priors, and okay, that's what you get. Well, some people on that grid would fall under an appropriate intermediate sanction, which would be a non-jail sentence. So they'd do time in the community, and we'd like to see that happen more. So we would like to see to it that money gets put into place. But what happens is this stuff is really biased towards women. For example, right now in the Ludlow jail, there's, like, what I say, 100 and, I don't know, upwards of 150 women sometimes. And not many of those women really have access to the programming on the inside, partly because it's a men's jail and the men get to sign up first for different programming, health services, et cetera, et cetera. So the women you might be arrested for prostitution and go in and do 30 days, but you'll never get to get any services because there's no way you'll get it in 30 days. And one of our friends who just did 90 days even wanted to get some dental care while in there and signed up and, you know, wouldn't have even been able to get the dental care until almost a year of being incarcerated. So you kind of can't get these services because women are trumped by men in the Ludlow jail. So we're kind of wondering, is there anything there around gender discrimination, gender bias, and in terms of when women are sentenced to the Western Mass Correctional Alcohol and Substance Abuse Correctional Center on Howard Street in Springfield, there's really only slots there for like 11 Hampden County women and 17 women total, and that includes some women from Berkshire County, Hampshire County, and Worcester County. So only 11 women can have that even as an option. And if you get into that program, there actually is a lot of programming that people can experience. And so I'm not advocating, again, for women to keep having to be under this kind of surveillance. But in this larger picture, it does seem as though there are some differences here around gender. So anyway, these are avenues trying to explore with various attorneys, and we just haven't had anyone. This would take some work, and someone would really need to commit to some volunteerism around this kind of thing, and we've come up short with help on it. So again, if anyone knows of any lawyer who really would want to give it this time, we've got this idea and others, and I do think that there's something there. We'd love to just demand an injunction, stop the thing, and then, you know, make them prove to us that's going to be the way to go. I think that covers the questions.
I just have two little comments that I would like to make, and one of them would be like, thank you for your kind compliment, and for the students and the young peoples, all I can say to you is we try to continue to reinforce a positive image and positive attitude, because I think positive attitude is going to determine how far we go in life. I remember when I was young that I heard again and again how bad I were, and I never amount to anything, and I almost proved them to be right because I ended up on death row. But thanks to the will and determination of a collective people believing in my humanity and believing, fighting for my justice, I'm here today, and thank you, and thank you all for being here and campaigning to end the death penalty, and all the wonderful peoples who've come here and from your many other duties, and to take the time out to listen. And thank you again for having me here. And I know if you continue to struggle, I'll venture to see you on the battlefield of struggle for justice. So take care and have a good night. Mm-hmm.